couple years ago, I was with my family, and we were spending some time in this cabin in the woods on the edge of this remote lake. And I mean, we were deep in the middle of nowhere. And one morning, my son Trace and I, we woke up and set out to take a walk around the lake. It was one of those mornings, like not a cloud in the sky, and the birds are singing, and my son Trace, he's about a little over a year old at the time. And so he's making all these little chirps and squawks that one-year-old boys make, and I had him in one of those hiking backpacks where he rode back here, so as I walk along, I can hear him making all his noises. And so we head out through the woods to walk around the lake. And it's just one of those, do you ever have those moments, like, if you could just freeze them? Just so beautiful. And we get to the other side of the lake, and we're exactly at the halfway point. We're the farthest possible point from the cabin, and we're rounding the bend to head back, and I look up and I notice clouds. And then it starts to rain. It always rains, doesn't it? It's interesting, because the scriptures say all sorts of things about rain and storms. When Jesus is teaching about what it means to live like the fullness of life in his kingdom, when Jesus speaks of it, he speaks of two different people. He speaks of a person who builds their house on sand, someone who chooses to reject his teachings, and someone who builds their life, their house on rock, who chooses to build their life on Jesus' teachings. And then the metaphor he uses is that of a storm that comes, and the person who rejects his teachings and his truth, essentially the house built on sand just gets destroyed, but the house that's built on rock stands. So this idea, Jesus says, when the rains come, it's not like they might, they do. It rains in our lives a lot. At first, there's a drop here and a drop there, and so I put Trace's hood over his head. But what I didn't know was that he pulled it off. And so gradually, the drops, they get bigger and bigger, and they fall faster and faster. And in no time, it is pouring. I mean, the kind of rain that just soaks, it plasters your hair against your head, and the kind that just drenches your clothing. And at first, Trace, the thunder and the lightning, he's okay, but as it picks up and it gets louder and louder and the wind becomes more intense and the trees start to shake, Trace becomes more and more agitated. I can feel him, like, on my back. And at first he starts to whimper, and then he lets out kind of a little shout here and there, but in no time, Trace is shrieking at the top of his lungs. I mean, the wind is blowing, it's thunder and lightning, and we are just getting plastered with this heavy rain, and the trees are no longer providing any shelter. And Trace, just from like deep in his being, starts to yell and cry so loudly and with such passion and terror in his voice. It's interesting, because if you take like the word cry and you search the scriptures, you find this word comes up over and over again. Like even the book of Psalms, just the book of Psalms, if you're like to start reading through, it speaks over and over and over again of crying. Crying out to God. And God says these amazing things, like he says, when you cry out to me, I listen. He even says, I cannot ignore the cry of somebody who's afflicted. It's like if I'm hurting, lost, soaking wet, scared, confused, God says, you cry out and I hear. God even says that when you cry, he's close to the brokenhearted. He's close to those who cry out and admit they're scared, lost, soaking wet, and confused. See, there is this false, twisted idea out there among religious people that somehow you got to have it all together to have a relationship with God. That, like, somehow God's only looking for people who have no problems and have it all nailed down and can put on, like, the happy face all the time. And yet the scriptures speak directly against this kind of thinking. I mean, Jesus is even just straight ahead and he says, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden. I mean, the essence of salvation is crying out to God and admitting, I don't have it all together. It's admitting, I am lost, I am hurting, and this sinful nature that I carry around with me has really screwed things up for me. And God, if you don't show me the way home, if you don't fix things, if you don't step in, I am dying here. And this church, this kind of thinking is all throughout the scriptures. It's over and over again, God says to us, when you come to me with all your junk. Come to me with your problems. Come to me all screwed up, all messed up. Let me take care of it. Jesus even sets out looking for people. He even says this. He says, I'm not looking for the healthy. I came for the sick. It's interesting if you think about the storm from Trace's perspective. For Trace, the storm is his reality. He sees nothing else. The lightning and the thunder and the trees swaying and the raindrops and the water just dripping off him. It's all he knows. He sees no reality beyond this storm. What Trace doesn't realize is that as his dad, I would do anything to get him home. So at this point, Trace is shrieking at the top of his lungs in stereo right behind my head. And I stop and I kneel down and I take him out of the pack and I pull him close to my chest and I wrap my arms around him and I hold him so tightly up against my heart. And for the last mile of our walk, the entire time, I bend over and I whisper into his ear over and over again, I love you, buddy. We're gonna make it. Dad knows the way home. We're gonna make it. I love you, buddy. And over and over and over again, through the storm, I carry him home, clutched tightly against my chest, whispering, I love you, buddy. We're gonna make it. Now imagine if, like, years later, Trace is in therapy or something, and he drags up this repressed memory of the walk. And he comes to me and he's like, Dad, what'd you let me go through that for? I got all this junk inside me. I thought you loved me. How could you have exposed me to something that horrible, that storm? I mean, why didn't you protect me? I would be crushed. Because for me, that walk was one of my deepest, most intimate memories of my life with my son. I wouldn't trade that experience for anything. Maybe you're bitter or you got all this anger inside because of some things you've been through, some storms in your life. And you're wondering if he really loved me, if God really was there, he wouldn't have let me go through that. And maybe God is saying, no, don't you understand? I got to hold you tight. And I got to remind you over and over again, I love you, buddy. As it says in the scriptures, the book of Deuteronomy chapter 1, God's reminding his people of how good he's been to them. He says, remember, I carried you like a father carries a son. And now, may you, when you're soaking wet, lost, hurting, and confused, may you cry out, and may the creator of the universe take you out of your pack. May he hold you tight up against his chest. May he wrap his eternal loving arms around you, and may you hear him whisper, I love you, buddy. We're gonna make it. Dad knows the way home.
I love you, buddy. We're gonna make it. Dad knows the way home. That is the message with so much of the suffering that God allows us to go through. But there are reasons for suffering that we need to talk about. Pat explained to you the philosophical aspects of suffering and pain. And now I want to get the intensely practical. I want to share with you five of the things that God showed me over a five-year period about the value of suffering. My notes for this talk were jotted down in the back of my Bible, literally over a five-year period. And none of it is philosophical. None of it is abstract. None of it is theoretical. It's all intensely personal and practical. And I'm very grateful for the things God showed me. I love that video because it is at the heart of why we can trust that a loving God allows us to suffer. God allows us to go through times when we do not understand that He really is in control. And that's so much of the issue, as God says, I'm in control, buddy. We're going to make it. Dad knows the way home. Please trust my heart. The first thing I want to share with you about the value of suffering is that it prepares us to be the bride of Christ. Jesus has a big job changing his ragamuffin church into a glorious bride that's worthy of himself. Ephesians 5, 26 and 27 says that he gets very busy making us holy by washing us with his word so that he can present to himself a radiant bride without stain or wrinkle or blemish. How many of you have ever been to a wedding where, you know, all the bridesmaids have come forward, the church doors are shut at the back of the sanctuary, and that's the point at which I am not looking at the doors. I want to see the groom's face as the doors open up and there stands his bride. And often that's the point at which the groom will either look like he's about to burst with happiness or there's a good possibility he's going to have a meltdown and just start crying. One of our wedding photos for our younger son, Kevin, is titled, Don't Cry, Kevin, because he was about to lose it when he saw his beautiful bride at the back of the church. And Jesus is looking forward to the day when we as the bride of Christ will be standing there in our resplendent glory, radiant, beautiful, stain-free, no wrinkles, no stains, no spots, absolutely perfect and beautiful and gorgeous and worthy of the Lamb of God. However, we are a messy people. And he's got a lot of work to do. And suffering is how he achieves that. Suffering develops holiness in unholy people. That's how he takes us from our really crummy native, natural position and turns us into a beautiful bride. That's why I call it God's laundry room. What does a laundry room do? That's where you take dirty clothes and you wash them. So have you ever tried to get stains out of white clothing? What do you use to get stains out of white undershirts and shorts? And you use bleach. Have you ever gotten bleach on your hands? It's very caustic. It can burn you. It's very, very strong. Bleach is harsh. And then after you wash your stuff and it goes in the dryer and you pull it out, is it just perfect and ready to hang on a hanger? Oh, no. It needs to be ironed. Have any of you ever ironed anything? Do you know what an iron is? Okay, that's a good thing. How does an iron get wrinkles out? Heat plus pressure. Because you have to have heat and you press hard to get the wrinkles out. If you were the shirt that you were ironing and you could speak, would you say, oh, that feels good? What would you say?
Ouch.
That's exactly right. Bleach and ironing hurts. It's going to be pain and suffering. And as the bride of Christ, it hurts for us as well. But Scripture tells us that we are enabled to share in His holiness through the discipline of enduring hardship. More ouch. God disciplines those He loves, and when tough times come and the suffering comes, He is achieving holiness in us. I love this quote by Oswald Chambers, who wrote My Utmost for His Highest. He said, God has one destined end for mankind, holiness. His one aim is the production of saints. It's about making us set apart and worthy of the Lord. Another aspect of preparing us to be the bride of Christ is that suffering purifies us. Have any of you ever gone hiking in mountain areas? Is it safe to just, if you're thirsty, to scoop up a bottle and start drinking out of the waters or lakes in the United States? No. Why not? Why? Well, sometimes it's stagnant. Even what if it's running water? What's in the water? Microbes. Giardia is in every single freshwater supply in the continental United States. You cannot scoop up water and drink it without getting sick, with various levels of severity. When Ray has taken groups to the Grand Canyon and you're dying of thirst, you still have to filter the water because there's nasty microbes in there that make you very, very miserable. It's not safe to drink. The water needs to be purified. And there's stuff inside of us that's not safe. Sin and suffering deals with that by purifying us. Suffering also produces growth and maturity in us. Because left to ourselves, we are a dirty, messy, fleshly people. We need to be made pure, and we need to grow, and we need to be made mature. See, Jesus wants not only a pure bride, he also wants a mature one. Have you ever seen a 5-year-old at the altar getting married? No. The only people who get married are adults, and Jesus wants a grown-up, mature bride as well. And suffering grows us up. Have you ever met an adult who never suffered much, never said no to themselves, never experienced hardship, and they're immature? They're not very pleasant to be around. But James 1:2-4 says that trials produce perseverance in us, which makes us mature and complete. And Romans 5 tells us we can actually rejoice in our sufferings because those sufferings produce perseverance, which produces character, which produces hope. And all of that, there's a value to that suffering because it's making us grown-ups, spiritual grown-ups. Suffering does something else. It scoops us out and makes our hearts bigger so that we can hold more love for Jesus. Now, it's not unusual that we think about the fact that Jesus Christ loves us. The groom loves his bride. But so often we don't think about the fact that it's a relationship. He wants us to love him back. He doesn't just stand there going, whoa, I love you, but it doesn't matter how you feel about me. He wants us to love him back. Have you ever had unrequited love? Even if it was third grade, when you loved somebody and they didn't either care or didn't know you were alive. Some people have had unrequited love because they love Brad Pitt or Angelina Jolie or something like that. And it's unrequited love because you love them, but they don't love you back. Well, Jesus knows that, he knows that we know that he loves us, but he wants us to love him back. And suffering scoops us out. Instead of being shallow people of very small capacity, it enlarges our hearts. The Lord is creating for himself a bride with sterling character, but it's not fun getting there. Which brings me to another one of my favorite Oswald Chambers quotes. Sorrow burns up a great amount of shallowness. If you've ever known somebody who's shallow, they're shallow because they've never suffered. They've never known hardship. And they're not very much fun to be around either. Another thing that suffering does, it allows us to minister comfort to others who suffer. One of the most rewarding reasons that suffering has value is experienced by those who can say, I know how you feel. I have been in your shoes. We can minister comfort to others who are in the valley that we have walked through. And when someone offers you the comfort of having experienced that same pain that you're experiencing, it's like wrapping a warm blanket around your soul, and it's so comforting. a number of years ago, this year, actually it was 32 years ago, we were going to have our first baby, and when I was 7 months along getting ready to have this baby, I suddenly started bleeding, and it was way too early, and the doctor said, you need to get to the hospital. And I called Ray in a panic, and he took me to the hospital, and they said, you are about to bleed to death if we don't take this baby. So they did an emergency C-section, a cesarean section, and in order to give the baby every possible opportunity to live, because the baby was only 28 weeks along, and full gestation is 40 weeks, they didn't give me any general anesthesia. They did what is called a stick and cut procedure. So they would shoot me with Novocaine and then cut into my stomach and shoot me with Novocaine and cut into my stomach. And it took 1 minute to cut through the layers of skin and muscle in the uterus and pull out a little baby girl who weighed 2 pounds, 1 ounce. This was 1976. And even the neonatal intensive care units were very challenged by babies who only weighed 2 pounds, 1 ounce. At that time, I was so sick that my blood pressure was 200 over 120 when I went into the emergency room or into the labor and delivery, and it had a problem with the baby as well. And 24 hours after Becky was born, she had a massive cerebral hemorrhage, and so she was in a coma. During the first 24 hours, I was I couldn't get out of bed because I had had a very serious threat to my life. And the doctors and the nurses were saying that she was a fighter, and she was, although they had a respirator tube down her throat, they could tell that she was screaming and thrashing around, fighting to live. But by the time I was able to get out of bed and go down to the neonatal intensive care unit, she had had a stroke, and by the time I saw her, she was about this big. She looked like, she was only 11 inches long. She looked like a doll that I had had when I was little. We just called her Peanut because she was so incredibly tiny. And they allowed me to scoop her up and hold her, but she was connected to all these tubes. And as a matter of fact, she was having so much trouble breathing that a nurse was bagging her and pushing air into her lungs as I was holding her. But as the days wore on, she kept getting sicker and sicker, and she had less and less to fight for life with. And they sent me home, which is a very difficult thing when you've been expecting a baby and you go home with your empty arms. And this is not right. This is so not right. On her 9th day of life, Ray was working at the probe office, and he said all of a sudden he felt his little girl Becky calling him, calling out to him. So he got in the car and he went down to the hospital, and he walked in, and they said, I'm sorry, Mr. Boland, your daughter died 20 minutes ago. Would you like to hold her? And he said, yeah. And they cut all of the tubes, and they unplugged all the monitors, and they wrapped her in a receiving blanket, and they handed Becky to Ray and allowed him to go into the back room of the nursery and just rock his baby girl goodbye. So he was there for about an hour, just holding her and rocking her and thinking, she's in heaven. Her body is here, but she's in heaven, but I have to go home and tell Sue. And he sure didn't want to do that. He drove home and walked in the door, and my 16-year-old sister was there visiting with me, helping me. And he said, Julie, I need to talk to Sue alone. I just said, no, I don't want to talk to you alone because it cannot be good. And he said, we need to go in the bedroom. And so we went in the bedroom, and I sat on the bed, and he said, honey, at 1:20 this afternoon, Becky died. And I said, no! She wasn't supposed to die. This was our baby. We were going to bring her home. We were going to raise her up. No! And it was horrible, y'all. It was horrible. Parents are not supposed to bury their children. And we had to bury her in basically a casket the size of a shoebox. And it was the most horrific pain I have ever known. And as the months went on, I learned a lot about what not to say. We had some incredibly clueless people who wanted to comfort us, but didn't know how. And instead of just saying, "I'm so sorry," they said some really thoughtless things. At some point, I'll write a story or something about what not to say. But I can tell you, just say, "I'm so sorry." Those are powerful words. But there was something one person said that made all the difference in the world. She said, "If you cling to God and allow Him to strengthen you during this time, you may discover that down the road, this pain is not just about you. This is about somebody else down the road for you. And God is equipping you right now to minister comfort to other people down the road because you are experiencing what you need from Him right now in order to help them later on." And suddenly that made all the difference in the world. It wasn't just about me. There wasn't pointless pain. There were going to be people down the road that I was going to be able to minister to because of what we were going through. I loved that. That was a powerful word of wisdom. Your pain may be about other people. And suddenly it was instantly redemptive. It wasn't just, "I have to hurt and that's the end of it." It was about other people. And, you know, in the years since that time, there have been other people who have lost children. And I've been able to say, "I am also in the sorority of mothers who have buried their children, and I'm so sorry to have to welcome you into that sorority. We're in the club nobody wants to be a member of, and I'm so sorry to have to welcome you in. But we're here. There are others who have gone through this. It's horrible. It will hurt you. It will shape you in a way that will change you forever. But you will get through it. You won't get past it, but you will get through it. And you will live with this pain for the rest of your life, but it will do good things in you if you embrace the Lord in it." What I've also discovered is that by the grace of God, obviously, as you can tell from my tears, 32 years later, this is a scar that doesn't completely heal. It allows me to weep with those who weep. I never say, "Well, same thing happened to me, but it's over now and everything's cool." The reality is I have a baby girl in heaven waiting for me. And I look forward to seeing her. I have two sons who look forward to meeting their sister, who they know beyond a shadow of a doubt that she lives in heaven. And we all have a tender heart in our spot in our hearts that allows us to connect with people in pain. And God redeems that pain. There is value in that suffering. The thing is, too, that when people have suffered, it allows them to give grace to others who are suffering, because when you've suffered, you tend not to judge others who are experiencing that kind of suffering. One of the hardest things that can happen is when you're in pain, somebody judges you. It's like, "Get a grip. Come on. I know your dad died. It was 3 months ago. Get over it." Ugh. You know, that kind of horrific suffering, people can be very mean and heartless and cruel. But if you've been in that suffering, you're ready to extend grace and understanding and not judge people, especially those who are being swallowed up by the pain monster. You're ready to give them grace. You're ready to give them another chance and expect more for them. You understand when you suffer that when someone's in a lot of pain, life is narrowed to a survival mode. If you're in pain, life can be like looking through, doing life through a toilet paper tube, okay? Everything out here gets just blocked out, and you're just doing good to look at life through this tube. And if you're in a whole lot of pain and you can barely put one foot in front of the others, it gets to being to doing life like living through a straw. That's how narrow life can get. I got a call while Pat was teaching you from a friend of mine who is in that kind of pain tonight. She's in a hospital, and she was filling me in on the kind of pain she is. Sue, I can't write. I can't think. I can't talk. I can't paint. I can't talk to other people about how much I hurt. I can't even pray. I hurt so bad. And I said, your pain has pulled your life down to a straw, and all you can do, if all you can do is say, help me, if that's all you can do, that's okay. And the rest of us will intercede for you. The rest of us will be there and hold you up. It's okay to be where you are. And the reason I can tell her you're living life through a straw right now is I have been in that place where you live life through a straw. And it was encouraging for her, for me to tell her, it's okay to be where you are. I'm not asking you to do anything beyond what you're able to do. If all you can do is get out the words, help me. That is huge. So when you have suffered, you're able to give grace to others who suffer. And it also means that suffering can develop compassion and mercy in us. It helps us to have tender hearts toward other people in pain. I just recently interviewed someone for a story I'm going to write for our church newspaper about a couple that's been through a horrific time in their marriage. And I asked the husband and the wife, what difference has this made in the way you relate to other people? Because they help couples who are struggling in their marriage. And he said, I used to, you know, would have the perspective, oh, get a grip, you know, just buck up, dude. And he goes, I can't ever say that again because I know too much about how much it hurts to be disconnected from your wife and to feel like everything's falling apart. And all I will say is, the brokenness really hurts, doesn't it? It completely changed the way that he talked to other men and extended grace to other women. The compassion and the mercy that we're able to give to other people comes from the Holy Spirit, who gives us compassion and mercy. He comforts us. We turn around and give it to other people. And sometimes that's just a matter of being there, just showing up. Sometimes the most eloquent thing that you can do for someone, or the most eloquent thing you can say for someone who's in pain, is nothing at all. Simply showing up and being there. If you read the book of Job, his friends did a great job in the first few chapters. Actually the very beginning of the book, before they ever opened their mouth. They just sat there and they sat in his misery with them. It was when they opened their mouth that they got into trouble. So they were able to minister to him as long as they kept their mouth shut. The Lord is always there for us. Sometimes the best thing we can do is simply be there for somebody else. Another thing that suffering does is to develop humble dependence on God. It teaches us to depend on God instead of on ourselves. Do you remember several years ago when the Oklahoma City bombing happened? The Murrah Federal Building was bombed. And a number of people lost their lives. And one of the people who was in the building that day was Marine Corps recruiter Randy Norfleet. He lost 40% of his blood volume. He required 250 stitches. And when he was taken to the hospital in the ambulance, he never lost consciousness because he was too busy praying prayers of thanksgiving that he was still alive, even though he was being told he was probably going to lose sight in his eye. And this is what he said. Losing an eye is a small thing. Whatever brings you closer to God is a blessing. Through all this, I've been brought closer to God. I've become more dependent on Him and less on myself. And that's what suffering does. It helps us see the way we're supposed to relate to God, which is from a position of total dependency. See, the problem is we are needy people, and we forget that. And suffering strips away the distractions of life and helps us see how God creates us to be, which is desperately needy for Him. He created us to depend on Him, not on ourselves. And when we get to that place where we have to depend on God and we have to depend on other people, we can be at that place where we have to have other people pray for us, and we can only make it through 15 minutes at a time. I have a friend that when she is in the throes of deep, deep depression, she said, there are some days where simply making it from 1 hour to the next feels like picking up a a pot of boiling water without any mitts on my hands. It just hurts like that on the inside. And I get to the place where I can say, Papa, I can make it through the next 15 minutes if you hold me up. I can't go beyond that, but I can do the next 15 minutes with you. She is an absolute dependent mode on God. And suffering has done that for her. And see, we are desperately needy people, but we keep feeding the illusion that we'll do fine on our own. We don't really need God except in a pinch. But he created us to be desperately needy on him. And we're desperately needy because we are powerless to change other people. In most situations, we really need to put our dependency on God. Recognizing our powerlessness is actually the key to experiencing really a real power, because we have to acknowledge, God, I need you. I am depending on you, before his power can flow from his heart into our lives. I love this paraphrase of Romans 8:28. The Lord may not have planned that this should overtake me, but he has most certainly permitted it. Therefore, though it were an attack of an enemy, by the time it reaches me, it has the Lord's permission, and therefore all is well. He will make it work together with all life's experiences for good. Someone explained to me what she saw out of this verse, that no matter what God allows into our lives, because he is our shelter and our shield around us, it's like before it comes to us, he has taken it into his hands. He's examined it in every possible direction, hold it up to the light, and before he allows it to come into our lives, it's got his fingerprints all over it. Nothing hits us by surprise. God doesn't say, oh, that one got by me. Nothing touches us that does not have God's permission. And it may not be that he sent it, but he did allow it, and he doesn't allow it without there being purpose and meaning to it. Another aspect of the purpose of suffering, the value of suffering, is that it displays God's strength through our weakness. Here is the classic scripture, 2 Corinthians 12:8 through 10. Concerning this, I entreated the Lord three times that this thorn in the flesh might depart from me. And he has said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weaknesses, that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I am well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. See, our culture disdains weakness, but from God's perspective, frailty is a sign of God's workmanship in us. It means he's working on us, and he is stripping away all the false reasons to depend on ourselves so that we depend on him. Several years ago, God started changing my perspective on myself. In terms of the physical weakness that I've had to deal with almost my whole life. When I was 6 months old, I got polio, which has been all but eradicated from this hemisphere. You know, you got a polio vaccine when you were little bitty babies, and you've never seen it in your lifetime. But I was one of the last people to get polio before the vaccine was developed. Just a few months after I got it, the vaccine came out, and then it got very quickly, it was pretty much wiped out. Polio is a disease of the central nervous system, and it kills nerve cells. And it killed all of the nerve cells between my spinal cord and all the muscles in my left leg. So I was completely paralyzed from the waist down on my left side when I was 6 months old. A few days later, some little baby helper nerve cells sprouted up, and I was able to get some use back, about 30% of what was originally there. But in order to stand at all, in order to walk at all for the first 5 years of my life, I had to wear one of those full-length steel and leather braces that came all the way up to the top of my hip. Do you see Forrest Gump? Remember the scene where Forrest has these two braces on him, and he's running down the road, and they spontaneously spring off his body? Well, it doesn't happen that way, let me tell you. But I have had to deal with a weakened body my whole life. I have never, as I mentioned in the homosexuality lecture, I have never walked a single step where I didn't limp. It just has always been that way. And now that I'm getting older, those little helper nerve cells that sprouted up are pooping out. They were never intended to carry the weight of a grown body this long. And so I'm weakening. That's why I need to use a cane. I need to use the car, the golf cart, when I'm here at Ozark Conference Center. So I have to deal with the frailty of what it means to be in a severely compromised body that is going downhill. I don't know how many steps I have left in my life. I have no promise of that. As a matter of fact, because polio is a disease of the central nervous system, it is possible that I may lose use of my hands and arms at some point because the whole body gets affected. And I have to be thankful today for what I can do today because I have no promise for tomorrow. But God showed me something about that a number of years ago when I was meditating on the scripture about, you know, when Paul says, when I am weak, then I am strong, and that God's grace is sufficient. It's enough. And I realized that we can rejoice in our frailty, in our weakness, because those are the areas where we are like a window. A window is easily broken. It's fragile. If you take a baseball and throw it at a window, it will shatter. But the thing about a window is, although it's easily broken and it's fragile, the light streams through a window as opposed to an opaque brick wall, which is heavy and strong. You can run up against it. Nothing will go through it. But it's opaque. It doesn't let any of the light in. And I thought, would I rather be a window or a wall? The areas where I'm weakest and most fragile and most frail are the areas where God can be strong in me, where he can shine through me. I would rather be a window than a wall. And then I realized that the Lord Jesus was all window and no wall. There was no area in his life where he was completely dependent on himself, where he said to the Father, no thanks, I have this covered. He was completely dependent on God, and the Father shone through him in, because he was nothing but windows. He just, God radiated through Jesus in every aspect of his life. I would rather be a window than a wall. Sometimes our suffering isn't a consequence of our actions or even someone else's. Sometimes through suffering, God is teaching other beings about himself and his loved ones, us, like he did with Job. The point of Job's trials is that they enabled heavenly beings, both angels and demons, to see God glorified. And sometimes God trusts us with great pain to make a point, whether the intended audience is believers or unbelievers or the spirit realm. Johnny Erickson Tada is well known in the handicapped community. When she was 17 years old, she dove into a lake that was too shallow, and she broke her neck, and she's been a quadriplegic for the last 50 or so years. She is one of the shiniest people you will ever see. She is so dependent on Jesus. She has an incredible, sweet, mature spirit. She's completely dependent on everybody to wipe her nose and every other body part. There's nothing she can do for herself. And the Lord just glorifies himself in her. And so her perspective on suffering and on heaven is unlike anybody else's. I love that what she says about suffering. Whether a godly attitude shines from a brain-injured college student or from a lonely man relegated to a back bedroom, the response of patience and perseverance counts. God points to the peaceful attitude of suffering people to teach others about himself. He not only teaches those we rub shoulders with every day, but he instructs the countless millions of angels and demons. The hosts in heaven stand amazed when they observe God sustain hurting people with his peace. It's a great example of someone who understands how God comforts us in our afflictions. I love what she said also. You were made for one purpose, and that is to make God real to those around you. See, the reality of God's power and his love and his character are made very real to a watching world when we trust him in our pain. Andy Stanley, Charles Stanley, the pastor in Georgia, I believe, says that the world loves to watch saints suffer successfully because they see God glorify himself through us. The last thing I want to share with you is that suffering gets us ready for heaven. Suffering teaches us the difference between the important and the transient, those things that are passing away. It prepares us for heaven by teaching us how unfulfilling life on earth is, by helping us to develop an eternal perspective. Suffering makes us homesick for heaven. I have an appreciation of heaven gained from personal experience because as my body weakens, to be perfectly honest with you, I get frustrated with the fact of what I can't do, of the things that I've never been able to do and the really cool things that I wish I could do and I can't. When I was at Super Summer a few weeks ago, Super Summer, Arkansas, I was the dean of Green School. I got to teach about 180 high school students worldview and apologetics, and we had about 20 or so college students who were small group leaders with the high school students. And one of my favorite parts of the whole week was when they all got up on the stage of the auditorium where we were having our school, and somebody was playing this great song, and they were all up there dancing. They were line dancing. They were having the most fun. And I just sat there going, I want to do that. I want to do that, and I can't, and I want to. But one of these days, I'm going to get a resurrection body. I'm going to have a perfect, glorified body. And if they have swing dancing in heaven, I am signing up for that. We were just on a cruise a week and a half ago, and at Sail Away, my sister was out there doing the electric slide. Now, she just had back surgery. She was out there in a brace, being very ginger about her movements and stuff, but she was even doing the electric slide in a back brace, and I still can't do that. But one of these days, because she's a Christian, I will do the electric slide with her in heaven. But because I'm frustrated by the limits of my body, and I know that I'm going to get a new one that's going to be beautiful and glorious and strong. It's waiting for me in heaven. It's a real place. Heaven is a real place. I have a glorified body waiting for me there. More importantly, I have a daughter waiting for me there. Both of my parents are waiting for me there. Heaven is such a real place to me. It's like I almost know the zip code of heaven. It's so real. Ray said, heaven is more real to me than anybody he knows. That grasp of the reality of heaven did not come from reading it in a book, y'all. That grasp of heaven's reality came from suffering. Look at this verse in 2 Corinthians 4, 16 through 18. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. When you suffer, when you are in pain, you are so aware that there is an unseen reality that is more real than this physical world. It's not an illusion. It really is real. But we can fix our eyes, the eyes of our heart, on what is unseen. One of the effects of suffering is to loosen our grasp on this life, because we shouldn't be thinking that life in a fallen world is as wonderful as we sometimes are tempted to think that it is. When we suffer, it reminds us that we live in an abnormal world. This is not the world as God created it. This is almost like Plan B, although he knew all along that Adam and Eve would fall and we would be plunged into a fallen condition. Our souls protest every time we suffer. We go, this isn't right. I shouldn't be experiencing this kind of pain. That suffering points us to the fact that this is not the perfect world that God created. Interestingly, if there is no God, and there's no meaning, and there's no purpose to life, why would we get upset at evil and suffering? You don't see animals going, oh, I have to hurt some, when I'm giving birth. Thank you. When I'm giving birth, why am I in pain when I'm giving birth? Dogs don't ask that. They don't wonder about pain. They don't fear being euthanized. The fact that we have angst about pain and suffering shows that there's something really wrong with pain and suffering. And so people ask, what kind of cruel God would create such a broken, pain-filled world? And they're absolutely right. God would have to be very cruel to create a world with tsunamis and earthquakes and people who abuse and torture and murder innocent children, who blow up buildings and crash planes into buildings. What kind of God would create that kind of world? It would be cruel and horrible. But God isn't like that, because God didn't create that kind of world. That's like asking, what kind of architects would make a World Trade Center that just falls apart with this huge, horrible boom? Well, the architects are not to blame for the fact that the World Trade Center fell. The people who drove the planes into the World Trade Center towers, they are responsible for the fact that the World Trade Center fell. It's not the architect's fault. And it is not God's fault that we live in a fallen world. It's our fault. It's mankind's fault. So we long for the new heavens and the new earth, for everything to be set right again. That's what suffering reminds us of. A pastor friend of mine said, if this life were easy, we'd just love it too much. If God didn't make it painful, we'd never let go of it. Suffering dispels the mists of what doesn't matter, and he puts things in their proper perspective. We have a friend at church who lost his wife to Lou Gehrig's disease. And a few years later, I had heard from somebody that on the way to church that morning, his car had died. And I said, Pete, heard about your car. What a bummer. I'm sorry to hear about that. And he looked at me and he just kind of shrugged and went, that's nothing. And I thought, well spoken from someone that has experienced the deep, deep suffering of the soul. His car broke down. Big whoop. It really puts things in perspective. I just want to close with one word of wisdom that really encourages me. God never wastes our suffering, not a scrap of it. He redeems all of it for his glory and for our benefit. We have a God who scoops us up and holds us to his chest where we can hear his heart beating and says, it's okay. I love you, buddy. Dad knows the way home. It's gonna be okay. And in the midst of our suffering, that's when God is holding us the closest. Please take that with you.